I'm gonna give it 11.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Protecting Yourself Against Phishing and Online Fraud. If you guys weren't here yesterday, my name is Jamie Tomasello. I am the Manager of Investigations and Development for Internet Law Group. We're a boutique law group, or law firm specifically, in the Washington, D.C. area that specializes in anti-spam, anti-fraud, other cybercrime litigation for corporate clients. As I had done yesterday, there's a couple questions I'm going to ask, and those, if you have the proper answer, you can win a Red Bull. And insightful questions or questions that stump me about this subject matter could win The Art of Deception by Kevin Mitnick, which is a really good book if you haven't read it already. But I just kind of want to poll the room and see who we have here. Anybody currently working in IT? Good. And anybody specifically working on fraud solutions or anything, anti-spam solutions, things like that? Okay. Super. All right. Now, how many of you are not running a Windows operating system?
Not running
Windows. Okay. I mean, personally. Okay. How many of you currently have antivirus installed? All right. How many of you have software firewalls installed? How many of you have hardware firewalls, routers? How many of you have both software and hardware? Okay, good. Routinely run spyware or anti-spyware software? Well, this is really good.
Anti-spyware.
Currently employ strong passwords. Kind of. Okay. A lot of us don't admit to it, but it is. It's medium. Window users, is your user profile that you actively use currently using? Does it currently have admin rights? Okay. Well, technically, you're not supposed to. Anybody running Vista? Do you have UAC turned on, or did you turn it off? A lot of people, one of the good things about Vista is it does give you I don't run Vista. I'm just saying this from a security standpoint. One of the good things about Vista is that you can run different levels of, your profile's running different levels of accessibility, and it's nice, but it alerts you. Do you want to elevate? How many of you conduct your business or your personal banking online? How many of you use the ATMs in the convention center, well, in the hotels, the non-branded ATMs? Good. One of the major problems with ATMs is obviously skimming. And at DEF CON in Vegas every year, they have to have a security team sweep after the convention because there have been ATMs that have been affected and other security things that have happened. So every time there's a major convention or conference that you go to, I would not suggest using non-branded ATMs because there's a possibility that they've been tampered with and you wouldn't know. So I just wanted to get a sort of a... Sure. Well, when I'm saying non-branded, I'm saying you're going to this generic kiosk. It's not a major bank. It's not Wachovia. It's not SunTrust. It's not BB&T. It's just a freestanding. A lot of gas stations have these. It's a freestanding ATM. It's a service that's provided to give cash point access. Also, I forgot to mention, to kind of cut this question off at the pass, no, I'm not dressed up like Lee Holloway from The Secretary. This is just clothes that I'm wearing. So, but yeah. It's something to keep in mind. People think, oh, cyber threats. These are, phishing or malware. But you also have to keep in mind there are other kinds of fraud out there. So how to prevent being a victim? This is really what the whole presentation's about. Unplug from the internet. That's how you prevent being a victim. What this presentation's more about and the conversation that we're going to have here is about reducing your risk and mitigating any damages that you have. Almost all of us have had some sort of odd thing happen on our accounts or some odd activity from our computers. You may have been victimized, you don't necessarily know. So I'm going to touch on a couple of types of cyber fraud. There are several out there, but the big one... Go ahead. Oh, okay. The big one is phishing. And it's obviously, it's a social engineering technique. Either most of the time you get an email and says, hi, you know, this, I'm from your bank. There's been some unusual activity. Please log in at this link. Or like an Amazon or I'm sorry, not Amazon, but a eBay or a PayPal email that says, oh, there's been some sort of activity. We're going to cancel your account unless you log in and verify your information. So some of the different types of phishing, there's link manipulation, and I'll show you a couple of examples of those. Website forgery, man-in-the-middle attacks that are tied to website forgery, and phone phishing as well. Link manipulation. There is actually a link on here that is correct. This is our first prize time. If you guys could tell me which is the actual valid link, you win.
The bottom? PayPal.
Let's see, who first said thank you? Think somebody back there said thank you, network. I don't know. Raise your hand if you said thank you, network. Okay. Oh, you both get it. Here we go. The first link manipulation, the first one you see there, wachovia-dealer.geocities.com. This is an example where obviously it's a host off of a domain, wachovia-dealer@geocities.com. They obviously had to sign up this GeoCities account to host wachovia-dealer. The actual legitimate website is wachoviadealer.com. A couple of you got hung up on this bankofthevest.com. The name of the bank is Bank of the West. This particular URI was shown at a security conference, and professionals missed this one, so it's okay. Thank you, network. This is one of the domains run by Citibank that you get email from to join the network and to do things, transactions through. And paypal-security.com, it sounds like something PayPal would have, but it's not theirs. It's actually registered through a Chinese registrar, and we'll talk about this particular URI a little bit later. I'm actually going to go back to discuss website forgery. A lot of times, website forgery can be easily explained as the JavaScript altering the address bar in some way, either placing a picture of the actual legitimate URL over the address bar, or it quickly closes the previous address bar and opens up a new address bar. So that's some of the ways that they can forge the website, so you tricks you into believing that you're at the actual website, like your bank. A man-in-the-middle attack. How many of you are familiar of a man-in-the-middle attack? Okay, so a fair amount. Man-in-the-middle, ultimately, is something that injects between two parties without either party being aware of it. So it could be a proxy website that's processing your information onto your legitimate, let's say, bank, and the information's coming back to you. That's pretty much a very simplified example of man-in-the-middle. And phone phishing can be an email that you receive that says, call me, you know, call at this particular telephone. This is your bank. Call. The call to action in the email isn't a URI. It's actually a telephone number. So instead of, hey, you need to verify your account information, go to this website. Hey, verify your account information with this, call this telephone number. So.
We've seen those from regular mail, too.
Yeah, you will see those mail and fax. There's a lottery scam that says you've won all this money, you need to contact us, and they give you a telephone number. It's a very similar situation. So this is another example, I'd say, of link manipulation. This isn't a phishing email, but it's a very prominent email right now. The subject line says, oh my God, what are you thinking? Some other subject lines that have been associated with this are, dude, don't send that stuff to my home email. Are you kidding me? Rolling on the floor, laughing my ass off. Who is that you're with? Man, who filmed this thing? Or LMAO, you're crazy, man. And you see, it gives you a YouTube link. But if you mouse over it, the actual site you're going to is down in the actual bar, and that's an IP address that takes you to a site where you end up downloading an executable, and you're now infected with Storm. Storm right now is hammering our networks, sending out, it pretty much makes your computer compromised, and you become part of a botnet. This is probably the biggest thorn in our sides right now. It changes on the fly. You're seeing different types of URIs, different ways it's mailing. Investigators are actually getting hit by denial of service attacks through this particular botnet. So it's not our friend. If you see an email like this that advertises a YouTube link and it goes to an IP address, don't click on it. Well, when you go to the site, the thing is, I haven't gone to the site to actually watch it download and install. As far as I know, it pretty much just, it's either an installer, and if anybody else is familiar with Storm, please feel free to fill it out.
It shows a web page that says, oh, to view this video, you'll need to download this.
That's what I thought. Yeah. That's
Depends on how you're set up.
Yeah.
If you're set up to install whatever,
Internet Explorer specific. There are a number of ways you can make IE download code and never introduce itself.
Right. Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
Things like this. I mean, how good are McAfee and things like McAfee and Norton? And if you do your McAfee and Norton updates, say daily, how good are they at stopping downloads like this?
What if you actually went to the site?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say very. I mean, a lot of this stuff is like 0 day. I mean, when it hits. You know, they haven't updated it, so you're kind of hosed.
I'm information security manager over at College Computing at Georgia Tech. We're seeing a delay time anywhere from 48 hours to 5 days. For McAfee or any of the antivirus people to come out with a tool to catch these on the fly. Usually we have to filter them at the firewall using our own pattern recognition.
Go ahead.
What's 0 day?
Well, it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the first day of the exploit. So.
Say again?
The first day of the exploit.
Nobody's a 0 day. Basically, for anybody who doesn't know, a 0 day. Usually, what happens is a vulnerability comes out. The vendor knows about it. It's publicized. Everybody knows about it. And then sometime later, that an exploit actually comes out. A 0 day is where somebody discovers a vulnerability, develops an exploit, and deploys it, and nobody even knows that the exploit actually exists other than the bad guys.
Right.
And so there's a delay between
exploit
that
being what
something that can be used to break into your computer.
Oh, okay.
A vulnerability.
Right. So that's a very good summary.
Thank you. I can put together computers. I call it solder together.
Right. Like on the antivirus thing, between the 0 day and the fact that all of the I'm with RSA Security, like, but the fact that like all of the Trojans we've been seeing over the last few months are rootkit based. So once they're on their zero, you know, like before the antivirus catches up, you're going to have to just scrub the entire machine to get them back off. As he was saying, the fight really has sort of edged itself towards the network more than towards the actual individual desktops at this point.
You mean format the hard drive or something like that?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the thing is, that's the big problem is that there's a lot of zero-day exploits out there. I mean, you don't even know when it happens. I mean, there's no, hey, there's a published vulnerability, and then, you know, it's exploited.
Point that thing at me. I can speak loud enough. And why don't they catch these hackers when they do? I know it's probably impossible to catch them, but introduce them to, like, Gitmo and make them disappear.
That's what I do for a living. I mean, that's specifically what I do for a living. I'm not a security specialist. I don't know every exploit. I don't know exactly how they work. That's not my necessarily my job to do. My job is to actually find out who they are and obtain hard identity. So,
and make them disappear?
Well, not disappear, but they'll be put in jail, or they are fined out the wazoo, or, you know.
Cut off, like, one hand?
Well, I can't do that. I don't have that ability. I'm sorry. Yeah, well.
They force them to run Windows, which is even worse.
That was really funny.
The biggest problem is that they're in a lot of countries that don't give any care about Interpol or, like, extradition or anything at all, and it's very hard to get hard identification on a lot of them, too.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard, but it can be done. I mean, the basic idea of everybody's in Russia or in Eastern Europe is a fallacy. They're not. They are everywhere. But, I mean, there are people who are aiding and pretty much being a facilitator for them in the U.S., and they've flipped and brought people over, and, I mean, it happens. It's not easy. I will definitely say that, but it does happen where we catch people who are domestic. Or, you know, we're able to, even if they were domestic, we're able to repatriate their funds. And if they decide that they want to stay outside the U.S., then we can arrange to have their passport go away. They're no longer, you don't have the rights of a U.S. citizen if you decide to give it up. So.
If you revoke their passport, a lot of times the country you're in will deport them back to the United States for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are different ways you can get them to come back. And it's really having a corporate victim who's willing to go that far. And a lot of times corporate victims don't always want to pursue into international, you know, past international borders unless they have an international presence there. You know, there's a lot of companies, the pharmaceutical companies, who have a base of operations there. Well, they'll file a civil suit there and pursue them in that particular country instead of having to fight and bring them back. So it really depends.
Mm-hmm. You hear about the bombing threats against Walmart? I understand that was a guy from, that's probably out of the your area.
Yeah, it's a little out of, I mean, there's a lot of different threats. I mean, there are threats against Lowe's Home Improvement a few years ago. I mean, it's common.
This one was fairly recent. The guy was in Brussels or something like that, and he said, you know, mail $10,000 or else I'm going to turn Wally World flat.
Right, and we're actually going to talk about that as another type of threat, so similar to it. Okay. So another kind of cyber fraud here is vishing. It's a combination of social engineering and voice over IP, and not to read from the slide, but it's an automated recording that alerts the consumer that their credit card has fraudulent activities and instructs the customer to call the following number immediately. One of the things with voice over IP, you can do a lot of caller ID manipulation. So the telephone number that's on the automated phone call can match the phone number on the caller ID, and then the victim calls the number, and they're given automated instructions to enter their credit card or their bank account number on the keypad. And that way they have now obtained their credentials. So that's something that's out there as well. Other types of cyber fraud, 419 scams. Anybody know why it's called a 419? I'm gonna go over here. Go ahead. Right, it's in their criminal code. It's part of Chapter 38, obtaining property by false pretenses or cheating. There you go. That's for you. Those are really common. I mean, if you've never seen a 419 scam, a very simple example is: Hi, I'm Prince Somebody from this country. I'm trying to get this money. Our government is falling apart. If you could assist me, I can give you a cut of this particular, you know, of this money. And then they'll ask you for for your banking information so they can start the transaction so you can help them facilitate this money laundering. Obviously, it's not legitimate, but a lot of people fall for it. It's very common. There's a lot of websites out there that talk about 419 baiting, where people are responding to these emails, as well as, Oh, yeah, it's really funny because these people are trying to get money out of people. I think Dateline did a, you know, to catch a con man and went over there and tried to get a 419 scammer on video. So, go ahead. That one, I think, is different than the one that they ended up in London. It's the same one? Okay. Okay, okay. Yeah, I thought they had a Nigerian. It feeds on our desire to make money quickly. You know, it in a way, people who fall for 419s are guilty to some degree because they're trying to get money outside of appropriate channels. You know, so not saying that the victim is bad, but it is too good to be true. Yes. Yeah, I mean, any sort of any crime that's possible in the physical world can be committed or facilitated by the virtual world. So you just have to be creative. I mean, obviously people go, oh, well, you can't commit murder over the internet. Like, yeah, the internet will facilitate that. So, I mean, technology is there, and people will abuse it, and crime abounds. So, natural disaster scams. Hurricane Katrina, there were tons of websites that were created that were fake charity sites that were bringing in monies that supposedly were going to go to the victims of Hurricane Katrina. It was such a problem that the different branches of law enforcement got together and actually created a Hurricane Katrina task force to actually go through these cases and bring these to justice, because it was just, it was not only gathering personal information from people, you know, handling credit cards inappropriately, but also these funds were being misallocated. They weren't going to Hurricane Katrina victims. And the same thing happened with the tsunami. Actually, that should be 2004. So it's wrong. And the one that we've been seeing lately are emails containing threats and extortion. There's also an extension of this, besides the fact that they're receiving an email that's threatening to assassinate the person. There is also one where your computer has been compromised, and this has happened more on a corporate level, where a server's been compromised, the database is held hostage, and they're going to either delete the data or not give you access to the data unless you pay the ransom. And a lot of companies would rather pay the ransom then bring it to authorities and have to deal with the fact that they have to tell their consumers that the data's been, that their system's been compromised. So we're seeing more of this cyber extortion coming out. Now, what are, you know, how do these cyber criminals work? How do we catch, specifically, you know, how do I catch a cyber criminal? Cyber criminals are always seeking false identity, poor reputation systems, a dispersed fingerprint, and a strong privacy policy. A privacy policy like Yahoo or, you know, any ISP, they cover, it's a one-size-fits-all privacy policy. If you're terminated, you're still protected by that privacy policy. Your data, you know, still for law enforcement or for civil enforcers to get that information, they have to issue a subpoena to get that information. They are not, you, they're not willing to just give it to you because you've inquired. And when I'm saying give it to you, appropriate people. I mean, you can't ask, you know, obviously you can't do it anyway because they don't allow it, but I'm not saying you should be able to ask Yahoo about a terminated customer, somebody who has a need for that data. It's a need-to-know situation. So they like to go to companies that have strong privacy policies. I'm sorry? Oh, I'm sorry. Let me back up there. Right. So it's a way of laundering your identity. Go ahead. A dispersed fingerprint would be, instead of putting all of your, like registering all your domains with one registrar, spreading it out through multiple registrars, or using multiple Whois information, using obviously not legitimate Whois information, using botnets to either send out your mail or to host your sites, compromised computers. There's a lot of different ways that all the different technical components, spreading it out as far as you can so that you're not this hot spot on someone's radar. Obviously, if you are abusing the bejesus out of an ISP, you're going to jump into their radar very quickly. If you're compromising smaller numbers of their systems or you're registering domains across multiple registrars, it's very hard to link all those together. That's something that we actually do, is find the commonalities. It's very hard for a criminal to lie uniquely, consistently. So here's actually an example. This is some cell phone spam. This is literally how it came in on the phone. It was advertising Vista and Adobe software, and the website, the call to action here is sws00.com. And sws800.com is a cheap software OEM CD's website. That's this is pirated software available for download, not legitimate. The registrant was actually registered with a Chinese registrar, and the Whois information was Xiao Wen at number 2 Chang Road in China. Another cell phone spam example. This one came several weeks after the first one. You can see it's very similar. It's advertising Vista again, except now it's advertising Office 2007 for under 40, I'm assuming dollars and not for people under the age of 40, at 200soft.com, the exact same website and the same Whois information. In our database, we were able to look up other websites that had the same registrant information, and it showed us this Elites Med website. This is where having an investigation, a very robust investigation, comes in handy. Because with downloadable software, you may purchase as an investigator, you may purchase that software, download it on your computer, and you only get some information. You may get some credit card transaction information. With this particular website, if you made a buy, not necessarily that the common person can do this, but as an investigator, if you made a buy of a non-controlled substance, like an erectile dysfunction drug, there's a possibility that they may ship it to you. And then you may get, you'll get additional data points, like where it was shipped from, how it was shipped. If they used a shipper like UPS or FedEx, that's an additional data point to subpoena. Now somebody paid for those services, so you start getting additional data points. If you're able to tie them to multi-industry spam, you're able to get more data points to find the identity. And then this is that website we talked about earlier, paypal-security.com, same registrant information. This is a phish website. And this is actually a screenshot of the site. It looks pretty good. I mean, it looks like a PayPal site. And I think for, like, my mom, if she saw paypal-security.com, she'd think that's a legit site. Sounds like PayPal. It's not. So all of these have the same basic fingerprint. That fingerprint appears in 600 domain name registrations in 2011. So he's been busy. Now, fighting cybercrime, it's about riot control. You are fighting a cyber riot. And just like a physical riot, you need to establish the ground rules in advance, monitor events, intimidate en masse, arrest the leaders, and disperse the crowd. We've noticed that in the way that we conduct investigations and our litigation and the steps in between, this model has actually worked. Some of the part of establishing the ground rules, you know, revising acceptable use policies. Looking at not only revising them, but posting them and making them very clear to the person who may be signing up for these accounts to engage in fraud. Putting out on your website, you know, these are the state and federal laws that come into play, and then establishing levels of cooperation with other international law enforcement. When we monitor events, we obviously collect samples. Either we collect samples from the spam feeds that are given to us from our ISP clients, or from complaints received by our manufacturer, like our product manufacturers. They get complaints, and they want to know, hey, out of your set of data, out of your community data, how many websites are advertising our particular drug? Or how many websites are advertising our software? And you capture those fingerprints, and then you identify the different hotspots. At that point, you find the commonalities. And you get feedback from those hotspots. When you've contacted them, you make undercover buys, and you share the information within the enforcement community, your clients, and other industry members. Intimidate en masse. Legal notices providing to hotspots providing material support. We call them our peer notices. We ask them to preserve information, investigate, enforce the AUP, and report on the outcome of their investigation. Go ahead. Acceptable use policy. So for example, let's say there's we see a website that has it's hosting in it. Well, there's a domain name that has false WHOIS information. Based on most registrars' acceptable use policies, they need to start the investigation process, and then if they don't get validation of that information, that they terminate the account. Stop the leaders. Obviously, you want to target the top offenders for investigative focus. A lot of times, it's easy just to pick the low-hanging fruit, but a lot of times, that's not going to make a major impact. Different things that we can do, obviously, is civil lawsuits, criminal referrals, extra legal actions involving the tax authorities in other countries. That's an example of an extra legal action. And technical responses. And then obviously disperse the crowd. You want to encourage the marginal actors to exit and force the committed criminals to consolidate around black hat providers or disperse across the white hat providers. You want them to continue moving. You want to disrupt their criminal enterprise. Now, I talked about different resources yesterday that are available. MyNetWatchman.net, actually, I think that's wrong. That should be .com. Sorry about that. Has a tool called SecCheck that if you believe your system has been compromised, you can check to see if there's any malware on your system, and it runs some analysis. There's also something called Hijack This that's also available for that purpose. If by chance you're not running any anti-spyware, spyware detection software, lavasoft.de creates adware. There's also Spybot Search and Destroy that's out there. It's easily accessible through download.com, which is CNET's website. Go ahead.
On the adware, Clark Howard, he's a consumer guy here in Atlanta, and he did a section on adware, and my neighbor called me said, hey, my computer vacuum buddy, he went and downloaded AdWare instead of AdAware.
No.
And their website looks exactly like the vendor's website. And they do clean off any spyware, or they clean off spyware, they clean off all the other crimeware to make sure theirs is the only one running.
Right. And that happens. That happens a lot. Right. There's a couple of lawsuits pending about that, because you know it says this is anti-spyware, but then you know it cleans off all the crimeware, all the spyware off your system, but then it starts inundating you with pop-ups, and you know it's just as bad. Another resource available, and it's primarily a forum, but there are incident handlers also that can assist you on castlecops.com. They have a phishing incident group, a malware incident group, and I think they've recently launched a spam incident group as well. They're a great resource. Also, if you are using Hijack This, they have some FAQs and how to sort of translate the reports, which comes in handy. Antiphishing.org is the anti-phishing working group. This is a great resource that's available right now. Also, if you're in academia and you want to get involved, they have a lot of options that are available for you in projects. Obviously, the IC3, which is the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, Whenever you do receive any sort of fraudulent email, you should report it to the IC3, as well as the particular company that it's targeting. Let's say your bank sends you you get a false email about your bank or someone else's bank. A lot of banks have abuse@bbnt.com or fish@wachovia.com. They have an email box to which you can send these emails. Also, the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, has multiple websites on both spam and fraud and how to prevent becoming a victim. Yep.
On the bank stuff, definitely use that. They aren't just going to ignore it. It's not just going to go into an email box where it gets put eventually. Usually the bank will funnel it directly to a service that will shut down those sites as fast as they can.
Right. Right. These don't get thrown away. Go ahead.
Well, they send out a gazillion of these emails, so is that important for each person to do it, or my statistics involve someone else?
I don't see as much fish sent out. I mean, just looking at what we receive, you can send less fish mail out and get a higher success rate than by sending just straight spam. So they don't necessarily need to send more email, you know, literally spam their fish. They don't have to. But it is important because you never know. If you don't send it, somebody else, you're depending on your fellow man to do it. And if we all take a little bit of responsibility and do it ourselves, then we're covering our bases and you know, trying to help towards a common good. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was just about to bring up. Yeah. It's not on a slide, but I'm going to go into it.
They go after very targeted, smaller populations that might have rich rewards because they can very easily for those accounts once they're in, and the banks might not have the resources to deal with it. So if you get any sort of fish attack, report it. People like that.
Right. And I mean, they're hitting credit unions, they're hitting brokerages, it's not just the major banks. And a lot of times, when these get reported, the smaller banks, the smaller credit unions, they can get overwhelmed. And there are a lot of industry professionals who are helping with the takedowns. Castle Cops, their PERT team, you can submit the fish to them and they will also assist in takedowns. Yeah. And especially if they want specific information, they can target a specific industry. If they want to go after teacher unions and different things like that, it sounds far-fetched, and you're like, oh, God, why would they want my login for this particular industry? But they do. Do you want to come up here?
It's very easy for them because there's some phishing kits out there now that can pop up a phishing attack in under 5 seconds. Throwing it out onto like a bazaar almost, where they actually sell like botnet time, they sell the malware, they actually have service plans where they'll, as soon as the antivirus patches for like an extra $20, they'll provide the undetectable patch version of the malware and through the control channel ship it out to everyone.
These botnets, I mean, they're very professional. I mean, they'll have SLAs, it's a service level agreement, that. Just so you know, so that if they say, okay, well, I need this many computers and this amount of time, and they're running like a legitimate business, they're trying to serve their customer, which is obviously a criminal, but it's still business and they have to run it like one. Reportfish.org is actually Internet Law Group's website. We collect phishing samples and spam samples. It doesn't matter, any type of sample, in through that particular feed that aids in our investigations. So please, by all means, if you get fish, you can also report it to us. And for your non-technical relatives that keep sending you hoaxes and all these god-awful forwards, instruct them to go to Snopes.com because it will help debunk some of these things. So it's not a technical resource, but if you get that email about Microsoft or Nike, you know, doing something with their products, you may want to just double check before you know you sign up and give your information to them. So it's that's some of the resources that are available out there. Now, does anybody have any questions? I kind of just covered it on a very top level. I mean, obviously you can drill down. I mean, you can even look in the Wikipedia article for phishing, and the RSA rootkit is mentioned in there, the ultimate rootkit that you guys found. So there's a lot of industry resources out there. If you want to learn more about phishing or really any type of fraud, it's out there. Just make sure that you don't, in your research, you don't get hooked by, you know, like adware versus adaware. Yes?
We just recently finished a study, like last week.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking for grant money to continue it, where they did a scan of the entire internet for all the DNS servers, which got me a lot of people complaining because they were hammering their networks. And what they discovered was there's roughly 16 million DNS servers. And one of the other things they did is they tagged so that each query they sent out was unique to that DNS server, so they could figure out which DNS server was responding to which response. And what it enabled them to do is it also would ask about specific domains like Bank of America, Wachovia, and they already knew what the correct response was. And they found out that roughly 8 million of the DNS servers would lie when they did the DNS query and would actually send them to a fake site.
Out of 16 million?
Out of 16 million.
There's also, if you're interested in studying DNS and how computers are being compromised, look up FastFlux. Right now, all those are not 16 million legitimate DNS servers.
No, they're not. That was the other thing. They're not all out of that 16 million. Not a great number of them aren't legitimate. A lot of the ones that are bad are ones that are legitimate ones that have been either co-opted by organized crime or ones that organized crime has set up. And with FastFlux, they move constantly, literally. I mean, whatever, about once every 10 minutes.
Yeah, there was a. I don't know if it's a couple years ago or just not even a couple years ago. It's probably less than that. They had 5 to 6 name servers listed for registration when they were fast fluxing. Now it's like 12. So it's getting harder and harder to shut these sites down. And they'll host anything. I mean, from child pornography to phishing sites. We'll see some of the analysis that we actually do at our office is we look at the life of a website and see what content has been hosted on there. And not just that particular domain, but how many unique query paths does it have? How unique is that URI? And we'll see where there will be phishing websites, pharmaceutical websites, downloadable software, all being hosted off the same domain, and maybe their paths are different, or maybe they're using the exact same URI but just recycling it. It's really, there are different methods out there, and they are willing to steal your money, steal your identity, do whatever they can, because to them it's a business. It's a way to make money, and it's at your loss, unfortunately. So it's being vigilant. Obviously, you want to have antivirus software. You want to have strong passwords. You want to report whenever you receive this mail. Whenever you have an incident of fraud on your account, even if it's a pre-authorization that's unusual, you want to be able to report that right away. You had a question?
You're talking about strong passwords. Now, can I assume you mean only in reference to important sites like bank or whatever? I mean, if I'm going on to Flickr, how secure does my password need to be?
That's an argument that some people have. Is this off the same question? Okay, go ahead, because I actually have an answer, but go ahead.
There was an article in Wired magazine that you can essentially bootstrap up, that, you know, you start from Flickr and you compromise that account, or you start from your Yahoo Mail and you compromise that account, and then you bootstrap up. So there's something you said for all your passwords, you really need to be strong to a certain extent.
Especially your email account, because your bank account is going to balance your email account.
Right.
You do a forgot password. So
And it depends on how much info you dump into your profile on Flickr. You know, if you have your, like, where you live and a bunch of other stuff on there so people can, like, you know, figure out that that's you when they're looking for their friend, that, you know, potentially.
MySpace accounts, Facebook, LiveJournal, I mean, these are all vectors of compromise. You know, this can all happen. I would rather you write your password down on a piece of paper and put it under your keyboard than you have a weak password. And for a long time, people were instructed, no, don't write down your password. Don't stick it under your keyboard. Don't put it in your desk drawer. Somebody may get it. Yes, but right now, if you have a weak password, they're more likely to break that. Go ahead.
Has there been any study done with banks that sort of gratuitously require people to change their password every 3 months, actually causing more problems than just a lot?
Actually, you might be able to answer that better.
They're not going to do that. That there's a big, every time you deal with a bank, which I deal with a lot of banks, there's a big problem between marketing and the security specialist. Anything that makes it harder for people to actually use the online channel and might make them call or go to a branch, like changing their password.
I've seen some small banks that
were... small banks are a little bit different. But anything that, like, will slow people down from doing their transactions through the cheapest channel, which is online, the marketing people are going to throw a fit. So it's, they try to balance it with the security. That's why you see, I mean, there's a good bit of security going on that you never see right now on the banks, especially the more progressive banks. I mean, everyone's seen the banks do, or try to do, stronger authentication and logging. You know, the pictures that you see so you can match them to your bank, challenge questions, knowledge-based questions. There's a bunch of stuff they have done that have slowed it down, that people feel safer, but there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes.
Right, and there's a lot of banks that offer an additional identity theft package, you know, that where they'll monitor your account for you for an additional fee. I mean, there's other upsell. I mean, they still have to do it anyway. And obviously, like, if you're going to go travel overseas, the reason why you need to call your bank, I was traveling to Prague. I called my bank because my bank would have freaked out if they saw something from Eastern Europe on my account.
One thing I recommend you do if you have, like, I have a bazillion online accounts. I use a password wallet or a password safe that's strongly encrypted. There's one called KeePass. It's open source. It's KeePass. It runs multi-platform. And use really strong passwords. You don't have to remember them. They're kept in there. They're encrypted. They work really good. That way you can use strong ones everywhere. Whenever you need to change one, it'll create one for you with using keyboard or mouse input to seed it to make it extremely difficult to crack.
And, I mean, there's always that chance that you've got a keystroke logger on your computer, so, you know, it's...
Take your picture?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Thank you.
Okay. Wait, hold on. Get her in the back first.
Okay, two quick questions for you guys doing the research. As I work in medicine, and I have 7 different systems I have to log on to, and it's, you know, 9-digit passwords for every single one. They each change in, like, 45 days. Of course, they're never changing the same. Do I have to have it? Do I have it written down on me, like the MRI password, the mouse marker password, you know, all these things? Have there been any studies that show that security is compromised from forcing your people to write down passwords?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I mean, yes.
So, like, if they would all change at 6 months' time, I could have them all, you know, here or have them like that. But, like, next week I'm going to change one. You know, and they, of course, they all remember every single password you've ever done in your life. So if you can memorize 3 of your best strong passwords, you can kiss that off.
Right. The problem is it's security versus convenience.
Yeah.
You know, what? Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm serious. If you want to come up here, you can. So you have a mic.
Define a good, like, what is the definition of a strong password? I'm assuming that changes very...
I mean, it depends on how many people are in your healthcare organization. There's solutions they could do that aren't as expensive to, like access management solutions. There's a lot of companies like CA, RSA, a few others, that have solutions that can pull it down into a hard, like a one-time password system that...
Key fobs and stuff.
Key fobs, I don't know too many of them, but you can pull it down to key fobs. You can pull it down to even software key fobs, like the software tokens you can keep on BlackBerrys or on Flex cards. There are all sorts of stuff where everyone in your company would only have to have one-time password they can carry around for all of the systems. And I'll even say it, RSA's Access Manager is not the big market share. I'd go, CA is the big market share if they wanted to investigate that.
Yeah. Kind of go into cryptography really, really, really short. The Russians during the Cold War They used one-time pads. So whenever they were decoding, you know, they used it that one time, and that was it. They didn't use it over and over. And a lot of the ways that we were able to break some of the codes was the fact that they started reusing it. When they started reusing passwords and ciphers and in their decoding process, that's when they had a problem. So a lot of the one time, obviously it's different because if you've got a man in the middle attack and they get their, you know, they get your information, you've got a keystroke logger, you know, it's different in an internet vector. But, you know, historically, one time use passwords or one time use codes were very strong. There's over here.
I wanted to ask about these password wallets. The browser I use is SeaMonkey, and it can remember your passwords for you. And I don't use it for any really important passwords, but just in general, what would you consider the security or the risk of using the integrated?
I don't save passwords personally.
I haven't.
I don't.
And you probably
like it.
I haven't seen a browser yet that actually encrypts what I do.
No.
There are a zillion tools for free that will go in and recover all your passwords for you.
And he's more talking about like on your BlackBerry or PDA or something, very like a desktop app. That's much more secure and much more encrypted. Saving it in the browser, it's very easy for for a piece of malware to go in, root through all of your browser stuff, even the lightly encrypted stuff, and break all your saved passwords. If you want to use something more secure, or write it down and keep it by your computer.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like to encourage people to write down their passwords, but if you cannot remember it,
Don't do that with your Word passwords, though.
No. Okay, here's a prime example. I will show you. There are two I work in security, and I have two passwords taped to my laptop. These are not work passwords. These are passwords to public access databases, where if somebody got these usernames and passwords, no harm in it. I just use them so often at work that it's just easier for me to just look down on the piece of paper. And my laptop, I mean, obviously I just showed you guys, but I don't, like, if you guys have super eyes and you saw what they were. And also, even if you had them, it's no big deal.
Could you do that
to me? No, but the thing is, it's in my possession. It's about maintaining possession of your passwords, knowing what your passwords are, where they are. And ultimately, you know what? You could have a super strong password and you could have it memorized and you change it all the time, but you get a good social engineer on the phone or you've got a really dumb assistant. And it's gone.
Yep.
So I mean, there's no silver bullet for this, for any fraud. There's no ultimate solution. Like I said, it's about reducing your risk and mitigating the damage and trying to catch it before it gets worse.
I want to follow up on this.
Sure.
Suppose I'm not using that strong passwords. Is it worthwhile to go to all these accounts and upgrade the quality of the passwords? Also, is there, if it's a minor account, is there any evidence that it has been compromised in some way?
Have you ever had your banking information compromised? Have you ever had charges that?
Absolutely never, and it'll never happen.
It's a pain in the butt. If somebody actually got your information, trying to dispute it and clean it up, especially if it's so bad, and I also advise you all, check your credit reports. You get them for free once. I think you get them for free here once a year.
Twice a year here?
Okay. Where I live, it's once, so I just want to make sure. Check it every year. And if you do use online banking, don't just go when you're going to transfer money or pay bills. Go get in the habit of once a week checking your accounts and making sure everything's good. So it's about maintaining it and dealing with it, because if you've got something on there, and even if you have a fraud alert on your credit report, that even causes problems for you down the road. So, I mean, you want to make sure that it's taken care of. Yes?
I used to have American Express in my, and I carried it all the time when I was in my 20s. And it would just physically break down, the card would.
Mm-hmm.
So I had like 5 American Express numbers. The one I had when I discovered someone had stolen like the third one,
mm-hmm.
I didn't physically have the card. I like tore it up and all that fun stuff, and someone had made all these interesting charges. And if I ever catch him, God have mercy. And one thing you say, I'll never say never, dude.
Agreed.
very careful.
Oh, another thing? That's what a lot of pregnant girls say.
Okay.
Aren't there ID theft? You can pay them money. ID theft prevention companies. You can pay them like $10 a month and up to $1 million.
There's ID theft insurance.
Yeah.
Is it worth it?
No, there's companies.
No, well, I mean, there are companies as well. I mean, and your, like, the credit reporting companies, like Experian, TransUnion, and what's the other one? Equifax. They also have, like, credit reporting services. When they see something unusual, they'll alert you.
Is it worth doing, or is it just crap?
It's mixed. I mean, they really will pay out, like, if you're a victim. Like, usually it's not $1 million ones. I'm a little skeptical about
it. Yeah.
That's a big policy, and that costs a lot of money to get from the insurance company.
And if it happens more than once, they won't pay out more than once.
But most of the time, it's about, like, they do, like, $10,000 to $25,000, like, ID theft policies that cover the lawyer costs of reestablishing everything, the mailing costs, the putting, you know, disputing costs, if there's any of those sort of fees. And they really will reimburse that. Whether or not you'll ever use it, I don't know. It's some peace of mind for, like, $9.99 a month, you know, less than $100 a year of an extra insurance policy.
The people that I think it's most important are like your parents, the elderly, people who are not familiar with the internet. That's where, if you're afraid that they're not going to be vigilant or they're going to open every email they get, then, and I say this from experience, I'm not just teasing, you know, other people's families, but it's true, it does happen. Then I would suggest maybe doing that for a family member who is not technically savvy. But if you're smart enough, something's going to happen, you know? It's inevitable. It's just dealing with it when it happens. So you just hope when that one time happens, it's not a critical compromise. You know, it's not where they have your whole identity and they go and buy cars and things like that. But, you know, you have the same problem if you're in a restaurant and you've got somebody who thinks that they're pretty slick and they have a handheld skimmer. They can get your credit card, too. Like I said, the ATMs. I mean, if they want your data bad enough, they can get it.
We also do that for gas stations. I work for a convenience store. It's called the convenience store chain.
Mm-hmm.
Every month we have to go in where you slide your card in and check pictures of the skimmers in there.
Yep.
They'll find any way they can get it.
Yeah, and they can get it. You know, you can get it.
You know, a skimmer with most of these, you know, credit card machines, you know, any manager has the passwords in the machine. You can grab the entire report of the day complete with the book.
I've actually got an ATM cell too. We don't have access. Well, I don't have access to your information. We work with a company called America One. They do all the ATMs. They're a good company. We're poor. We have ATMs and they run all of our gas stations and things like that. We don't do that. We always check that type of stuff. But I can't say for every gas station that's going to happen.
Right. I mean, the thing is, it's. This is I don't take this example the wrong way, but there are certain things that you do with your body, with people, and most people are, you know, disconcerting. They're not disconcerting. They
discriminant.
Thank you. Discriminant. I don't know where that word went. They're discriminant. Treat your credit cards the same way. Use protection. You know, you just be mindful of what you're doing. If you're not gonna. You won't even drive into a bad part of town. Why will you make a purchase on the internet in the internet bad part of town? It's using that same type of logic. It's just be smart. Yes.
Can I play off that metaphor?
Sure.
Don't do your online banking in free hotspots. Don't log into any account that you want secure on an unsecured wireless network that's free anyway. And also make sure that it's the little access point when you're using one of those and not a computer-to-computer connection that's just trying to, like, pretend to be an access point to get all of your details. Because
right.
If you ever open up, like, a Wi-Fi device in an airport or on a train or anywhere there's a lot of people, like this convention right now, if you open up a laptop, there'd probably be half a dozen free internet, like, little things that would pop up that would not be the, like, legal. You know?
Right.
So.
I mean, just be mindful of what you're connecting to and who you're doing business with. And I said this yesterday, I had a credit card that I had just opened up, and the first place I used it was at Woot.com. I've not heard of them having a compromise. I don't think, I've not had any problems with them. They may have, I have no idea. Not saying anything bad about them, but I only used it one place. And then about a week later, I received a pre-authorization charge for 1-800-Flowers for over $1,500. I know I did not buy anybody that many roses. So, I contacted my credit card company, and the first person I talked to said, oh, that happens all the time. It's a ghost charge. Don't worry about it. And I was a little irritated. She's like, it's not going to go through. It's not a problem. Don't worry about it. Your card. She didn't even mention whether or not the card's been compromised. I said, well, what's the number for the fraud department? And that's where I had them cancel the card, and we talked a little bit more about what happened. They didn't really have much details, and I ended up calling 1-800-Flowers to find out additional information about this particular transaction. And this particular transaction, they said the way that this happens all the time, the way that this happens is they want to see how much money is on your card.
What? You didn't have anything to do with that.
Oh, okay. No. 1-800-Flowers, okay. Legitimate company, they didn't do it. Okay. This is not 1-800-Flowers doing it. It's just they're the merchant charge. The way that their system is set up is if you put an invalid street address, the order will not go through. However, when you're initially making that purchase, you put in the credit card information, whatever amount of flower, every flower possible, 99 flowers, and you'll get an email back that says you've been, authorized and the charge is going to go through. We'll send you your UPS. And Amazon does this too with an email where it says, we'll send you your confirmation later. And then they kick the order out because it has an invalid street address. And they didn't log any information. They didn't have an IP address. They didn't have a date and time. They had no information about this preliminary transaction because it gets kicked out of their system after a certain period of time. There's nothing I could do about it.
So essentially, it was a bad guy trying to find out how much you credit.
Right.
Testing the barbarians, testing the walls of your castle.
Right. And, if I wanted to play around with it, I could have kept the card open and see where it went. But I didn't really want to deal with having to get that stuff off. The investigator in me was like, awesome! Literally, awesome, when I woke up that morning and saw a compromise on my card. Because I was just off to the races, and they don't like when an investigator calls and they're like, you know exactly what to say and what to ask for. They're not happy. They don't want to have to deal with me, so. Sure.
What is your opinion on using throwaway credit card numbers?
I'm sorry?
Throwaway credit card numbers.
Touring credit card numbers?
Throwaway.
One-time use cards.
Yeah.
One-time use cards or prepaid cards?
Like, for example, Bank of America has this thing where you can generate a new credit card number with an expiry date, say, of 1 month, exactly with pretty much the amount, which is what I regularly use. Like, whenever I'm doing an online transaction, I'll say that one-time use, and if I'm buying something for $30, I just say $30. So it seems to be free, and one of the downsides of doing that is that
RSA man, do you want to answer this?
It's something Bank of America is trying. It actually works pretty well. It's like basically you're walling off a small portion of your funds into like a number that's just generated for internet transactions. That's a valid credit card number with an expiration date. And if anyone intercepts it, they can't go over the amount or the one use that you point to spun it off to make a quick purchase with. So it's fine.
Yeah, it's just not convenient all the time. Sometimes you're not carrying. It would be interesting if you had a generator, a portable generator when you need it whenever, but what if you lost it? It's just not convenient.
It's very similar to what they're doing in Europe with transaction signing,
mm-hmm.
which it requires you to carry a little, reader, where you're in a little, card, and you put it in.
Credit stick?
If you want to go the Shadowrun route, but it's, you sign the transaction, you tell it that you're going to, transfer money to that bank account number, and it digitally signs the transaction, and makes sure that it's a safe transaction from hand to hand. They're rolling that out in the UK, but you have to carry a little reader device and a little card, and it's not necessarily the most convenient solution to the problem.
Most of us are already carrying a cell phone and an iPod and a PDA and their wallet and your keys and your eyeglasses. How many other things do you need to keep track of? And so what it comes down to is convenience. If you want the one-time use, sure, that's convenient for you. And I don't think it's necessarily bad. I know a lot of people who use prepaid cards, too.
Well, I think the way the Bank of America thing works is you actually need to call them up where you can do it online and generate it. So you don't have to worry something.
But I mean, the problem is if you're going to go to, say, Amazon monthly, you really want to generate a one-time use monthly. But, you know, part of it here is you're also trusting that they don't keep the account number and that their database is secure, and you don't wind up with a TJ Maxx situation, which is a, you know, Boston situation where basically their entire credit card database got compromised.
Yep.
And I'm pretty sure something like that happened to me because someone started doing bogus charges and they had my email address and they had my cell phone number and they were shipping it to my house, which leads me to believe it was one of these buy 10 things, get a free iPod for free or whatever.
Mm.
But, and I, you know, from everyone I talk to a number of security people, and I work in computers myself, it seems like that just had to be someone's database that was, you know, that was stolen, where they had the charge card number, they had the email address, they had the cell phone number and stuff like that. All
there's database, I mean, there's obviously the credit card databases from your merchants, there are databases from ISPs, I mean, there are stolen lists all over the place. There's also, a lot of times I'll hear people go, well, you know, I had this card and I've never used it. I used it once, I put it in the closet for 3 years because I just wanted to build my credit. I didn't want to actually do anything with it, just wanted an open card. And there are lists of cards that just get used. It's very hard to track down exactly how your card was used. I mean, obviously, it's easier with a phishing attempt because you got that email and that's where it started. Or in a phishing investigation or even in a spam investigation, when we run across compromised cards, we a lot of times contact the victims and say, do you know that you've got compromised cards? Or we contact the bank and say, we've got cards that are compromised that we received in a subpoena response. Have you contacted these subscribers? Do you care if we contact them? Because we want to see if there's other types of abuse that's been going on and hopefully aid us in tracking this whole criminal enterprise. Back there.
Two questions for you. Quick, you said when you contacted the credit card about this phantom charge, you knew the right things to say to light a fire under the investigators. What were like some of the things what would you recommend to us when we're doing
that
are the right things to say to make them take us more seriously? And then number two, how can we get copies of our credit card transactions that are phantom? My bill doesn't. How do you find out? Like, I'd love to get a list of every month my phantom transactions.
Your pre-authorizations.
Right. How do you
get? I have no idea. Right, but that's if you're looking at it at the moment. I mean, you're not going to see your month worth of all the holds you had.
Right. You'd have to go on every day.
You'd have to go. Well, I do. I don't actually balance my checkbook. I will honestly admit to that because I check my bank account all the time and I see my check card holds. And I've even called the bank when I couldn't recognize the local Sunoco used a different merchant name because his wife has a bakery in the same place and the business came up as a bakery. And they're like, oh, well, this is the physical location. Here's the telephone number. And it depends also on your bank. Some banks are easier to work with than others. But as a consumer, you should be able to request even without filing a fraud report, you should be able to request the merchant data, like who was this merchant, what is their telephone number. Sometimes you can even get what's called the acquiring bank, the bank that is responsible for that merchant account, who holds that merchant account. So you can contact that bank if you're having difficulties getting in touch with the merchant. You should be able to get that information from them. But that's after it's posted. I mean, pre-auths, you're not going to be able to get a list of all the pre-authorizations your cards ever had. You just have to be vigilant.
Yeah, from my little experience down this credit card thing, well, I don't have credit cards, I have a debit card, which is even worse. But why did he ship the merchandise to my address?
What was your whole scenario again?
I had, like, 5 American Express cards.
Right.
Took the third one from the current.
And he shipped the product to your house?
Yeah.
Are you home often?
Just get a free iPod thing, usually.
No, this was like I had 5 American Express cards.
Hold on, but what was the item that was shipped?
Yeah, what was shipped?
Art?
Yeah, it was like, $700 worth of art.
How many years ago was this?
5, 10, something like that.
Are you home often?
It's a different address. It's my mother's address. I used to live with her, so it's been a while. And I just sent it back and got a...
It depends. I mean, there are some scams where people watch your house and they have stuff shipped to your house, and instructions to leave it at the door, and because they're checking the credit card against their address, and so they want to actually receive the product, and they will come and pick up the package when you're not home. But I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of details on what it could be. I mean, you have to look at the whole run of the scam and be able to say, okay, it was charged by so-and-so, this is how it happened. But I've seen it where they arranged to have the package shipped there so they could pick it up physically.
You're making me want to buy a gun.
It's not going to help you unless you're going to shoot your computer.
Tell the person.
Well, yeah, no, I know. Go ahead.
Somebody commits fraud with your information, and this information gets into your credit report. How do the credit reporting companies escape liability for, repeating this bad information? I mean, they're the ones who are broadcasting this, and they're the ones damaging your credit. How do they escape liability?
Do you want to answer that?
Sure. The legislation kind of shifts it onto the consumer.
So it's crooked, essentially.
Well, no, because they did legislate tools for if you do your free credit report, they made it so they can't charge you for it anymore to check what's on there, and you can dispute, and there's pretty established channels.
Just means dispute, it's still there.
No.
No.
When you dispute a fraudulent charge on your credit report, they will take it off.
Okay. Now that's different. I know I mentioned earlier I said fraud alert on your credit report. You can put your credit report into a fraud alert status that you think your identity has been affected, so you will continue to have weird things show up. And so they have to take, extra vigilant steps if you're going to apply for additional credit because they think, they're expecting a car loan to come through. I mean, that's different than you had a fraudulent charge that went into collections that you had no idea about, and then you dispute it. That's going to come off with, obviously documentation and working with people, but yeah.
It's not easy, but the credit rating will go back up if once those are pulled off.
They right.
Like, it doesn't go on forever. That's how they escape liability.
Right.
There's one thing to think about with credit reports is they're not out there for you. The credit report was designed for the company.
I know.
And you get a free credit report, but you do not get your credit report number.
Your score.
You have to pay for that. And to get your credit score, recalculated is very difficult. Your credit score affects how much your car insurance costs, everything. So it's still very much against the consumer, and the laws protecting the companies are against the consumer. So it's up to us to
still crooked
to make. But one of the questions I had for you is from a law standpoint, where can, as a consumer, can we refuse to give our social security number? And where can the business not be allowed to say, we're not going to take your business? Because, like, for example, you want to start electricity for your house,
right?
And they demand your social, and you're like, no, and they're like, well, we're not giving you electricity. What?
Right.
Like,
I don't specialize in consumer fraud and consumer affairs and that type of law. There's that whole argument where the purpose of the social security number was not supposed to be used in the way it's being used.
Do you have any websites or anything you recommend to go to?
Yeah, the Patriot Act has done a lot of things to fraud laws and identity theft laws. I don't have one specifically for consumer actions like that.
There's a site called ClarkHoward.com, and he has a couple of people working for him where he gets on the radio. He won't say what the name of the company is unless they don't straighten up and fly right. And he sticks his consumer people on him, and he flat gets stuff done. It's called ClarkHoward.com. The show is based out, it's a radio show, based out of Atlanta. They have a website, they have a hotline you can call,
okay,
and you get all kinds of information.
Yeah, I think there's one back here.
With regards to the credit agencies and things like that, even though part of the deck is stacked against you, because I had some credit discrepancies where, TransUnion was 350 points higher than my Experian score.
Wow.
Well, Experian had me living in Oakland circa 1978, and then TransUnion had me at my current address, which is interesting. I would suggest that you actually start with your bank. I have a credit union, and I had a very nice man named Greg sit me down for an hour and told me how to do things and how to go about changing, my credit scores and who to go to and who not to go to first. In this case, to fix my Experian scores, talk to Experian, because according to the law, even though the onus of the liability falls on me to fix it, by going to Experian first, I actually activate parts of the law that makes it beholden to them to respond to me in 30 days.
Right.
And respond to the charges within 30 days. And if I have problems with different credit providers, if I go to Experian first, they have 30 days to contact Banana Republic, who then has 30 days to respond back to them, to me. If I went to Banana Republic specifically, it could be 6 months. So actually talking to a trusted banking professional, they can actually walk you through what to do and how to do it.
Right. Sure.
I came in late, so I apologize. But are you a commissioned officer, a lawyer?
No, I'm actually...
fighter?
No, I work for a law firm. So the best... I mean, I'm a manager, technically. I'm the manager of investigations and development. I'm a registered private investigator in the state of Virginia. I am an investigator as a titled trade, but I do everything from email analysis to paralegal work to obviously private investigator work. So my experience has been in the abuse and security field for the past several years, specifically focusing on ISPs and cyber fraud related things. So,
cool.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Is there any way to get industry to help out a little bit? Because for one time I was baiting a lot of these criminals, and I was collecting credit card numbers from them in order to ship things to Nigeria. And I was just taking those numbers and turning them around, calling the credit card company and reporting them as stolen.
Be very careful with that. I would not handle credit card data information. I mean, there are...
Yeah, but they didn't make it easy to report it. I mean, you had to go through their horrendous phone tree system, and you would get someone on the phone and sound like they couldn't care less.
There are... It can be viewed as vigilantism, and they could turn it on you. I mean, I've not seen it happen, but, I mean, there are professional security people who deal, you know, who get credit card information from phished systems. You know, they'll do whatever they need to. They don't actually hack into the systems, but let's say they find the drop email location and they actually get the text, or they're monitoring, you know, they've injected themselves or got permission from the compromised computer owner and actually they're getting a live stream of data, and they already have arrangements set up with the actual banks. One of the places, if you're interested in that particular, you know, how that's, well, not really how it's done, because they're not going to tell you, but there are people who do that for a living. And if you just do it and just bait people, it's very
risky.
Yeah.
You know, just about every business is being inundated with people trying to place orders for anything you can imagine to ship, either ship it overseas or through an intermediary. And I've actually had that same person to ship some whole shipment of plasma TV screens to an empty building right next to mine.
Right.
And I turned around and called the companies that shipped it and said, hey, this is stolen. I'm going to refuse the UPS charges on it, so they send it back to you. Be careful. These are criminals you're dealing with, so at least there was no loss on it.
Right. I would, if you want to get involved, there are different, and it depends obviously what your industry is and how you can be involved, but like I said, you can get involved with Castle Cops has different response teams that deal with the takedowns. Your pretty much your local FBI agency has something called InfraGuard that you can participate in. Secret Service has the Electronic Crimes Task Forces in areas. There's all obviously industry professionals who do it for a living too. If you're just doing it for fun, I wouldn't touch a credit card number. There are rules about how you're supposed to handle that data. I mean, laws and regulations about handling of that data and disposing of that data and just being in possession of it, because it's identity data. And there's some really strict identity theft laws that say, well, if you got the person's name and if you have two pieces of identity, you know, you have now stolen their identity information.
I'd also say that if you start looking into if you at all get anywhere near credit cards, start looking into PCI compliance laws.
Yep.
They're scary. I mean, right now, like, just don't do what you were doing, like investigate ways to like this, because a zealous prosecutor could like, it'd be very hard for you to prove that you weren't involved in any of the scam.
But
you
it'd be so easy to get this information because the criminals are so aggressive. I mean, I'd like to think that, you know, these, the real people, the professionals, would like to have people out in the field to report to them to have their own little network. To have
we don't need unauthorized agents. Unfortunately, and law enforcement is the same way. When you become an agent of law enforcement, it becomes a liability both for you and for them, and it can actually disrupt their investigations. So they're very strict about having informal investigators. But if you want to get involved, I mean, you can contact, I mean, there are places where you can get involved and start, you know, learning about the different ways of handling the data and how you can help them. A lot of times it's, they have that data. That's not what they need help with. You know, they can get credit cards out the yin yang. That's not the problem. You know, there's other ways that you can help them. But yeah, I would not suggest handling credit card data unless you absolutely had to. Yep.
Are there any concerns if, you know, you don't have a lot of credit cards, you don't really buy much, you don't have a house, a car, or anything, tons of credit inquiries.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like a red flag?
Well, I mean, how a lot of inquiries on your account?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, on your, when you look at your credit report?
Not like so many companies that query your score, blah, blah, blah. They get, all right, 10, 12, you know, hundreds, thousands. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I would obviously be concerned if you've got hundreds of inquiries, but it depends on who you have financial and transactional relationships with. Because a lot of times, like, for example, the bank that I bank with, that I have, you know, one credit card with, their child companies, subsidiaries. Gosh, those companies have the right to contact you, and it also depends on the terms of service. They may say, well, we have these business relationships that may either contact you for additional business or make inquiries to provide you credit. So, I mean, obviously, if you have hundreds, there's something going on. If you've got 12.
Talking pings on your credit report, like them, like, you know,
you're going to
get
that free credit report and it says so many, they don't list who the people are, they say,
yeah,
so many.
If you're talking that more than, like, you know, the offers to extend you credit, yes, there's something definitely wrong. You should be able to match up every, every time something hits your credit report is like alert worthy, like they've like checked into your credit rating. You should be able to match up in your head every time that happens because it shouldn't be that often. We're talking when you go to get a car loan, when you go to get like a Sears card or another credit card or anything like that. That's the only time that you show up as a pure, like, you know, hard hit.
I disagree 100%. You go out, you get a, go out and buy a house in Massachusetts, it's a public record, you buy a house, and there are a whole bunch of people who are going to pull your name from the public record and they're going to start doing credit checks on you, especially if they'll go buy a database from one of the banks, they'll do a credit check on you, and you'll wind up with all these secondary mortgage applications just full, and they're all showing up.
Well, the thing is, you just said people who buy your bank's databases. You know, there's some sort of relationship there.
Yes, I understand that, but there's no way you're ever going to figure out who your bank's, who Citibank, who American Express, who Bank of America, who your local bank is selling your database to.
No, not always, no.
Yeah.
Well, what a lot of banks don't tell you is they have an opt-out program carefully hidden. You actually have to go tell them no, and a lot of them will honor it if you tell them no.
However, they honor it. They usually have laws where they honor it 6 weeks after the initial transaction. So when you're signing the mortgage paperwork, you cannot opt out at that time.
Right.
You have to wait until you're in the system by which it's already been distributed, and then 6 weeks later you get the opt out. And the other thing is, I don't know if it's, but I think it varies by state. You can put, it's not a freeze, but you can, in certain states you can block these pre-authorized people from checking your credit. Like they have
yeah.
to. But it varies, I believe, by state. I think there was something where they shot down a federal.
And I don't, you know, I don't know the individual details for the consumer credit stuff. But there are, yeah, there are opt-out mechanisms. But
California's the best.
Yes.
Right. So, but I think we've need to wrap things up. And I really appreciate you all coming out, and those who were attended both the spam one yesterday and this today. And hopefully we'll continue this possibly next year.
Yes.
Thank you.